in which Charles Dickens gets a nod, exploding hoverboards make an appearance, and Helen Gurley Brown brings it home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 12th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with all appropriate deference to Charles Dickens with a tale of two markets. Neither the best nor the worst of times exactly, but surely worth a comment or two. Equities on this Tuesday, stocks, that is, hit record highs for both the S&P 500 and the Dow, a sign one might well and often does assume of investor confidence. And yet there is, at the same time, near record demand for the safety of government bonds, which drives down the yields those bonds pay, the interest rates, which is usually a sign of investor skittishness. So how can both conditions be true? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on.
You know how on nature shows they show those migrations of the wildebeest, like millions of them, the cow-like things? You know the ones I'm talking about.
It will take weeks for all the wildebeest to arrive.
Investors are like wildebeest, but instead of rampaging to greener pastures, they look for yield, money. Right now, one of their safest, greenest pastures has dried up.
Central banks around the world have caused a collapse in yields.
Samir Samana is quantitative strategist with Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Central banks have kept interest rates low, and bond yields too. In parts of Europe and Japan, they're even negative.
So investors around the world are reaching for yield. It forces people into equities, into alternatives.
Lawrence McDonald is creator of the Bear Traps Report. So people are being driven to U.S. stocks. And some international investors are looking at U.S. bonds, too, because their yields are at least positive compared to elsewhere. So the yield is greener.
So that's keeping demand from international investors high for assets in the U.S., whether it's treasuries or even U.S. stocks.
Jay Jacobs is with Global X Funds. One final thing driving the herd is that a lot of investors have been keeping money in good old-fashioned money markets and bank accounts because they thought the Fed would drive up their interest rates. But the Fed did not. Again, Samir Samana.
That hasn't gone up in rates as much as people thought, and stocks and bonds both have benefited.
After 7 months away, the herd is returning.
Returning to U.S. markets where the yield is greener. Or at least a little less brown and parched.
And nothing will stop them now.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, so I lied. What we have today is actually a tale of three markets: stocks, bonds, and the labor market. 18,000 employees of JPMorgan Chase opened their newspapers this morning and found out they're getting a raise. In an op-ed in the New York Times, CEO Jamie Dimon said the bank is going to raise its minimum wage from the $10-ish an hour it pays now to somewhere between $12 and $16.50 an hour. Over at Starbucks, meanwhile, baristas and store managers got a similar memo from their CEO, Howard Schultz, yesterday. So, coincidence? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at economic conditions and rising wages.
We're in a tightening labor market, meaning as the unemployment rate falls, workers start to pop their little heads up from behind the desk or the cash register and realize, I have options.
Finally, you know, this long nightmare, maybe I can make some headway here.
Sylvia Allegretto is co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at UC Berkeley. She says it took a long time for us to get here. On the employer side,
the firms start to kind of fight over the workers, right? And trying to hold on to their best workers who now have opportunities to leave, perhaps, where a year or two or certainly 5 or 8 years ago, they didn't.
She says the labor market is especially tight in the service and restaurant industries. Both Starbucks and JPMorgan Chase mentioned valuing employees as motivations behind the hike.
I think there's two things going on here.
Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says, yes, the labor market is tightening, but we're also in the midst of a big campaign, led in part by unions, to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And income inequality has become a big issue just about everywhere, but especially during the presidential campaign.
I think we're seeing maybe a turning of the ethic that companies want to be seen as good employers. So I think that's been a real effect of the fight for 15 and other efforts.
He says wages starting to tick up. It's not quite a pop the champagne moment, the economy's where we want it to be, but it is a step in the right direction. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Yay, he took the scenic route. We're switching to politics now. But Senator Bernie Sanders got to his long-anticipated destination today, endorsing former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for president. Yes, she had racked up enough delegates long ago, but Bernie does have something that Hillary needs. In fact, he has millions of things she needs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
First things first, this isn't about the money, although Clinton will certainly take it.
We accept $20, $27 donations too, you know.
A nod there to the millions of Sanders supporters who floated his campaign with their small donations.
You know, she doesn't have a money problem, but she has more of an image problem.
That's Ray LaRaja at the University of Massachusetts. What Clinton really needs are Bernie's energized supporters.
Especially young people. They're hard to track down, and the Bernie campaign has tracked them down.
As in an estimated 5 million email addresses, just the thing to help Clinton connect with and potentially lure all those Sanders supporters. Luis Calderon used to work for the Sanders campaign, but is now at nonpartisan Rock the Vote.
I think that that list contains a lot of people that were not your traditional Democrats. There's a lot of independents in that list. There are a lot of people who are coming into the political process for the very first time.
But not everyone on that list just wants their data handed over.
You know what? We're not for sale, and don't give us away.
Karen Higgins is a co-president of National Nurses United, early Sanders supporters.
So unless you're willing to call everybody and ask them on that donor list, I personally don't think you have the right to give it away to anybody else.
No word yet on how that's going to play out, but it's common for campaigns to pool donor lists behind one nominee. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note ticked up to 1.5%. See what I did there? Bonds instead of stocks, like Sabri was talking about. Brown, parched, that whole thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're inside a week until the GOP convention in Cleveland, Ohio. The countdown is on for Donald Trump's VP announcement. Inside the next day or two for that, cable news is saying. The media and the delegates are gathering in Cleveland and businesses are gearing up. Thankfully, we know a guy who runs a business in Cleveland, Ohio. Steve Presser is the owner of Big Fun Toys. We talk to him every now and then. We figured today was really as good a time as any to do that. Steve, it's good to have you back.
Always good to talk to you, Kai.
First things first, and as I ask every time, how's business in the toy business?
The business is always fun in the toy business. It, like everything else, it's cyclical. It's been up and down. We had an off month last month, and we're hoping that July and August will be different and stronger because our summer months are always good.
Is the convention going to bring business to you?
We hope so. Nobody here in Cleveland knows exactly who's going to come and how far they're going to venture out of the perimeter downtown. But we're hoping 50,000 people are coming here.
Yeah, you're going to do a pop-up shop at the convention site, I understand, or nearby.
I am going to be almost in ground zero, a stone's throw if you're a good outfielder, right around the corner from the convention.
What's the mood is kind of a lame question, but what's the zeitgeist? What's the vibe around town today?
As I always used to tell people, expect the unexpected. But really, the vibe, you know, we're ecstatic that we have the convention. But, you know, let's be frank about this. This is a very unusual political year, and people really don't know what to expect. This is a very unusual one that even the brightest and the most knowledgeable and the most experienced do not really have an answer right now.
When you go to Chamber of Commerce meetings and you're talking to the caterers and the, you know, the household goods people and all that, what do they expect? What are they hoping, I guess?
Well, out of the gate, everybody was ecstatic. You know, we thought it was, you know, it's going to be great for business. Everybody was on top of the world. But what's happening now, the last couple weeks, and this is one of the unknown that we didn't know about, is that the caterers are now claiming that the number of meals to be prepared and served and the number of people at each event, those numbers are down. And so what I think, just as a layperson, is that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who just don't want to come to this convention. It has nothing to do with Cleveland. I mean, Cleveland, our city, has never looked better. It's just that the politics of having a convention and what's happening in this so-called circus is different than what they expected at first.
Let me run a phrase by you that is being bandied about at the very macro and in fact, geopolitical level, right? The idea of uncertainty, whether it's Brexit or this election or the state of government in America today. Are you feeling any of that?
Absolutely. I couldn't, you know, like I said earlier, expect the unexpected. Uncertainty is the one word that probably captures it for all of us. I mean, politically, economically, and even socially. This is one that the pundits and the powers to be and, you know, the knowledgeable out there really don't have the answer.
Steve Presser owns Big Fun Toys in Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Presser, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Last week was a tough one for the exploding hoverboard market. 500,000 of them were recalled after almost 100 incidents of batteries catching fire or the aforementioned explosions. The Consumer Product Safety Commission also said that from here on out, all hoverboards ought to be UL certified, the letters UL, which raises the very natural question of what UL is and how come it gets to decide. Gigi Duban explains now from Birmingham, Alabama.
I went around downtown Birmingham asking people one random question.
Have you ever heard of UL or UL certified?
I think I remember seeing something like that on the electrical parts, but outside of that, no.
No, not aware of it at all.
UL stands for Underwriters Laboratories, as two other people pointed out. They work in the insurance industry. The rest of us only have a vague notion, if any, of what this company does. Fact is, UL is all over your house.
We estimate there are about 125 UL marks in the average American home.
John Drangenberg is the consumer safety director for UL. The company is based just outside of Chicago and has 94 labs around the world. In those labs, testers make sure your TV doesn't explode, your toaster oven doesn't spark, your hairdryer doesn't melt your scalp. This company started with lights 122 years ago.
There was a World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, and as you know, World's Fairs highlight the new innovations of the day.
At the time, it was the light bulb. But there were no electricians, so prepping for the fair, workers would slap up some lights and just nail wires into the wall. Of course, there were fires everywhere. The promoters got nervous, and they called in an expert from Boston.
His affiliation was the Board of Fire Insurance Underwriters.
That was William Henry Merrill, who later founded UL. Today, the company tests more than electrical stuff. There's an entire room at UL where every day testers burn roof shingles over and over. UL develops these safety standards along with manufacturers and the government and tests for them. About 22 billion UL marks land on products every year. But as Kenneth Ross, a product safety attorney, points out,
the limitations of UL are that you can have a UL-listed product, but that doesn't mean that it is safe.
That just means the UL-tested component of the product is safe. Take the hoverboard battery, for example. The UL-certified one might not explode, Ross says. But that doesn't mean you can't still hover your way right into a wall. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the percentage of sex-related material was between 5 and 7%.
You know, in case you're counting, the woman who made Cosmopolitan magazine really cosmopolitan. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. 2 out of 3 records. Today, the Dow Industrial's up 120.6 tenths%, 18,347 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 34.7 tenths%. 5,022. The S&P 500 moved up 14.7 tenths%, 21 and 52 there. It is Amazon Prime Day, but So what? Shares down 0.7% today. Competitor Walmart is trying to steal its thunder this week with free shipping. It shares down 1%. As we said earlier, JPMorgan Chase is boosting wages. Its share price got boosted as well today, up 1.5%. Big week for bank earnings this week. It reports Thursday. Citigroup does. Wells Fargo follows on Friday. It up 0.5% today. Beer lovers, you have until 2020 to ignore how many calories you're drinking. That's when labeling is going to come in. Voluntary guidelines announced today. I'm opposed, by the way. Anheuser-Busch InBev, basically flat, up less than 0.1%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're at the halfway mark of the baseball season. The All-Star Game is tonight in San Diego. And there will be, I'm sure, plenty of highlights on SportsCenter right after the game. But through the first half of this season, a lot of baseball's brightest moments have been captured in a much more traditional form, albeit updated for the digital age. Elizabeth Brockway reports from New York.
When the Topps Company in Brooklyn started selling baseball cards 65 years ago, it was mostly as a ploy to get kids to buy bubble gum. Hard, hard bubble gum. At least, that's how Michael Bofshever, also 65 and from Brooklyn, remembers it.
And depending on how long the cards were at the candy store, some of that gum was, you know, could crack in half. You know, it wasn't pliable.
Bofshever, by the way, he's my uncle. And he grew up buying cards from the local candy store with the dollar allowance his parents gave him.
You stuff the gum in your mouth, and then you'd shuffle through your cards to see who you got, and you'd read the statistics.
But today, practically any stat you want is online, making baseball cards all but obsolete, which is why this season, Topps is trying something new. They're calling it Topps Now. They take great moments from individual games and turn them into cards overnight, and then sell them for just 24 hours online for only $9.99 a pop. The most popular card so far? On May 7th, Mets starting pitcher Bartolo Colon hit a home run. He's 43, and he doesn't have your typical athletic figure. He's lovingly known as Big Sexy, and this was his first ever Major League home run. It was the perfect moment for a Topps Now card, said Susan Lugedi, the company's marketing manager.
It was kind of a no-brainer, that situation. There was no sort of like, you know, should we? It was like, all right, this is definitely happening.
They sold almost 9,000 cards in the single day it was available, over 5,000 more than the next most popular card. And it's even selling on eBay, sometimes going for over $50. When I visited Topps, Associate Art Director Michael Linkins was searching for a photo to help make a card for that day, another bestseller.
We do lean towards celebratory moments a little more, a Gatorade bath or a curtain call. We try to capture the moment best we can.
The night before, another Mets pitcher, Noah Syndergaard, hit two home runs in one game.
We consider things like what will crop best in a card. Will it be vertical or horizontal?
So what are you leaning towards?
Well, that's a nice shot.
He goes with a photo of Syndergaard high-fiving a teammate as he arrives at home plate, his famed flaxen hair flowing behind him. But despite Lincoln's best efforts, not everyone's a fan. 23-year-old Ian Wenick prefers traditional baseball cards because the money payoff can be much higher. We're talking over $1 million for some of the uber-rare cards. And when it comes to Topps Now, Wenick says,
I think that's just sort of a bit of a gimmick, and they're just kind of trying to bank on virality and stuff kind of spreading, hoping people to hop on that bandwagon.
But the next generation of collectors, like 9-year-old Avery Rosen, think it's cool, and he mentioned a future Met celebration he's hoping to order online.
I would want Yoenis Cespedes to hit a walk-off two-run homer in the ninth inning to win the game 2-1, maybe in the playoffs or something. That would be pretty cool.
It would be pretty cool, and who knows? Maybe Avery's hopeful card or Bartolo Colon's surprise hit will be two of the classics going for the big bucks in a few years. In New York, I'm Elizabeth Brockway for Marketplace.
It's a very long way from the Ozark Mountains to the top ranks of the publishing world in Manhattan, but it's a distance that Helen Gurley Brown covered, although not without some bumps along the way, eventually becoming a best-selling author, a feminist icon, and a very successful businesswoman. Brown is the subject of a new biography by Jerry Hershey called Not Pretty Enough, The Unlikely Triumph of Helen Gurley Brown. She started as a secretary before finding a home in advertising because, as Jerry Hershey says, Helen Gurley Brown could flat out write.
Oh, she could sling it. She was a very talented conversational writer. Huh. And when she married David Brown, she was 37 by then, single a long time.
Yeah.
It was David who read some of her love letters, actually.
To another man. Right, okay, there we go. Yeah.
But he was struck by that same conversational tone. And to make a long story speed ahead, she got this book idea from him, and they worked on this idea, which became Sex and the Single Girl, which was published in 1962 to great horror acclaim and profit. And that was really the springboard.
Fast forward then just a couple of years, 1965, she winds up working for Hearst at Cosmo. And they take what had been a not doing really well magazine and they give it to her and say, run with it, basically, right?
It was dead in the water. In fact, they were sending back 140,000 copies a month. Now, Helen, she ran smack into a really interesting demographic in the 60s. There was an 80% rise in single households, mostly in cities. Huh. And she was right in the pocket with this magazine and had, at that time, no competition. And she was the only one speaking forthrightly about sex, reproductive rights, and that sort of thing.
It wasn't actually sex, right? It was the idea of being able to think, talk, and enjoy the idea of sex, right?
Let us say it was an aspirational magazine.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, there was some instruction,
mm-hmm.
not how-tos in those days.
Right.
Actually, someone did an analysis because Cosmo has always had this rap as a sex magazine.
Yeah.
But when Helen started, and for quite a number of years into it, the percentage of sex-related material was between 5 and 7%.
Mm-hmm.
She also had a genius, what we call in magazines, a mix. I mean, she would run articles on a day in a nuclear power plant.
Wow.
And, you know, things that will make your husband happy.
Huh. And she makes the magazine profitable, right? To
absolutely.
Like in a short period of time, like in a couple of years.
In about 3 years, she had gotten it from, you know, kind of moldering in the 600,000s to close to 1.5 million.
Circulation.
And yes, and the ads just exploded. The ads, when she took over, the ads were at about the same rate of pages as they were in the 1880s.
Oh, man. And yet, and this is you in the book, the glass ceiling at Hearst had the primal fixity of a polar ice cap. I mean, she
Indeed.
Was a woman in this male-dominated industry, and they let her know.
She saved Cosmo. And yet, in 1972, so, you know, 7 years into it for her, one of the executives there said, you know, Helen, this, you know, your sell-through, meaning her great percentage of mm-hmm. copies sold, is fabulous. We love you. But I have to tell you, you can't come to the big Hearst anniversary party because women aren't allowed.
Man.
It was that way. They gave her trinkets, you know, a Mercedes and this and that. But they never paid her what she was worth. They would not let her have a viable travel budget. So she was kept on a very short leash.
Younger women today, younger career women, I wonder if you walked up to 10 of them and said, can you tell me who Helen Gurley Brown was? How many do you think would know even a vague sketch?
Very few. And I think in part, I wouldn't say the company has forgotten about her, but in the big ad, a full-page ad in the Times announcing Cosmo's incredible world domination now, 68 million readers in digital and paper, 64 editions at that time, 100 countries, 37 languages, Helen was not mentioned once. So there has not been any, you know, great reverence in remembering what she did.
Man. The most recent book by Jerry Hershey is called Not Pretty Enough, The Unlikely Triumph of Helen Gurley Brown. It's actually fascinating to read this book. Jerry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a quick follow to our story about Pokemon Go yesterday. We told you that people are basically playing that game everywhere. Well, from the Marketplace desk of Too Much of a Good Thing, these updates. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is warning people not to play the game while driving because, come on. Also, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. and Arlington National Cemetery have had to ask people not to play there. Also, because, come on. All right, got to go. The Dow Industrials up 120 points today, 0.6%, 18,347. Yes, a record. The NASDAQ up 34.7 tenths%, 5,022. Not a record there. However, comma, the S&P 500 moved up 14 points, 0.7%, 2,152. Yeah, record. Tommy Andres and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwood, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.